Let's look at the bibliographical test for the Old Testament. Remember, this is also called lower criticism or textual criticism, whereby we try and figure out, are we reading what they wrote, these original authors? We have numerous different trees of manuscripts, one of which is the Septuagint. This is also described as the LXX. Like, remember, the Super Bowl. You have Roman numerals here. It's the same thing. L stands for 50, XX, X is 10. So the LXX is the 70. Supposedly, as tradition says, 70 different rabbis and translators went through sometime between 250 BC and 132 BC. And they all did separate translations of the Hebrew Bible into Greek because the Greeks were really Hellenizing, enculturating Israel with Greek culture. And so all of a sudden it didn't become a thing where people knew Hebrew. They knew Greek. And so these rabbis wanted to have a Bible that was translated into the common language. And so they translated the Hebrew Bible into the language of Greek. Supposedly all 70 rabbis came out with exactly the same translation. People really doubt that that ever happened, because how could they ever do that with such precision? It could be that they were trying to show that this was a theologically warranted thing to do by God, that you could come out and translate it just so perfectly. Well, we get this figure because, we discover that in 250 BC, I think it's Ptolemy Philadelphus mentions the Hebrew Bible being translated into Greek. And then the prologue of Ecclesiasticus, the apocryphal book, not Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiasticus, mentions the Old Testament being dressed up into Greek. So that kind of gives us a window that the Old Testament was translated into Greek at that time. And guess which Bible the New Testament authors quote from most regularly? The Septuagint. On the order of 80% of the time, they quote from the Septuagint. A far more reliable text than the Septuagint, because that's a translation, after all. The Old Testament was not written in Hebrew. It was written in, it was not written in Greek. It was written in Hebrew. The best text that we have, far and away, is what's called the Masoretic text, or the MT. If you're doing your reading, and somebody says the MT reading says this, it's the Masoretic text. Now, the Masoretes were a strict fraternity of Jewish brothers who translated their Hebrew Bibles, transmitted their Hebrew Bibles by copying the words so anally retentively that they basically were maybe not as in much as of a quantity as the New Testament with all the manuscripts, but in the quality. The Masoretes were so strict of transmitting the text, it's actually ridiculous. Well, for years, our best manuscript for the Old Testament was from 900 AD. Codex Cairo, Codex, all these different codices from the 10th century AD. Until 1947, where a young Bedouin boy is on the Dead Sea, and he's herding his sheep. And his sheep go up into one of the caves, and he takes a rock to throw in there to kind of scare his sheep out. And as the sheep come running out, he hears a big crash inside the cave. Well, he's a young kid, so he goes up into the cave, and he sees a big potsherd, like a big clay jar. And he looks at the jar, and he sees it's broken. He starts to pull back, and he discovers these cylindrical scrolls on the inside. Well, one thing leads to another, and he's thinking to himself, maybe I can make some money off of these. Well, biblical scholars discovered that there were these cylindrical scrolls, and they found numerous hundreds of manuscripts near the Dead Sea, which have been dubbed the Dead Sea Scrolls. Walter Kaiser, who is an Old Testament scholar, he says this. He says, these caves have yielded some 800 scrolls with parts, or in some cases, the entirety of the text of all 39 books of the Old Testament, except poor, poor Esther. She's not in there. The dates generally given for the Dead Sea Scrolls on the basis of paleography, numismatics, and what slight archaeological context surrounds them in the caves where they were found is from the mid-3rd century BC, so 250 BC, to AD 135. That would be a very late dating for some of these texts. In Cave 1, So the Qumran caves, or the Dead Sea Scroll caves, the first cave that they explored, in one of the potsherds, they found a 24-foot-long, 10-inch-wide, complete manuscript of the Book of Isaiah, which dates to about 150 BC, before the time of Christ. This thing was just absolutely amazing. Now, imagine being a skeptic or a critic back during the 50s when the Dead Sea Scrolls were coming on the scene. Wouldn't you just be salivating, just thinking, our earliest manuscripts are from 900 AD, and now we've got manuscripts from before the time of Christ, 1,000 years earlier. Oh, this is going to be fantastic. It's going to show that the transmission of the Hebrew Bible was completely messed up. Well, contrary to that expectation, Kaiser says of this Isaiah scroll, only 3 words exhibiting a different spelling were found for a book that runs about 100 pages and 66 chapters in our English text. Have you ever read through the book of Isaiah? You know how long it is, right? 3 words were different. That's how faithfully transmitted the texts from before the time of Christ were to the time of the Masoretes. That means that they were copied and recopied and recopied for 1,000 years with such precision that the text is almost identical. Well, what were some of the things that the Masoretes did? Well, here's Frederick Kenyon. He's an older scholar here. He's a British paleographer. A paleo means old, like the paleo diet. Graphe means writing. And so he's really into ancient writing. He says the Masoretes numbered the verses of their text before they would copy it. They numbered the words, how many words were in Genesis, how many words were in Leviticus, and they numbered the letters of every book. They calculated the middle word and the middle verse of each. So when they finished a manuscript, they would go through and count. Let's say Genesis has 5,000 words and however many verses and however many letters. They would go through and count and find the middle verse, and then they would find the middle word. And after they finished their transmission, if that didn't line up perfectly as they counted all the way to the middle, they would, well, he says this. He says these trivialities had the effect of securing minute attention to the precise transmission of the text. And they are but an excessive manifestation of the respect for the sacred scriptures, which in itself deserves nothing but praise. The Masoretes were indeed anxious that not one jot or tittle, as Jesus said, not one smallest letter or tiny part of that letter of the law should pass away or be lost. The roles in which these regulations are not observed, where they didn't count, they didn't get the colophon, is what they called it, and get right to the middle word, the middle verse, the right number. When these weren't observed, were condemned to be buried in the ground or burned. Or they were banished to the schools to be used as reading books. So many manuscripts we found have been because this is what they gave to the kids, which in that culture, they didn't treat kids with high regard. So this is kind of like the trash that the scribe screwed this up. And so, yeah, let's give it to the kids to read. He said a damaged or imperfect copy was at once condemned as unfit for use. So these guys, as I said, anally retentive probably puts it lightly. They were scrupulous in how they transmitted the Old Testament text. Rabbi Ishmael, this comes from Soda 20a, he says, my son, be careful because your work is the work of heaven. Should you omit even one letter, the whole world would be destroyed. Or think of Josephus in Against Appian, book one, where he says, you know, what Greek would die for their scriptures the way that we have died for ours? Indeed, during the Maccabean revolt, the authorities at the time, Antiochus, came through and would kill people if they had a Hebrew Bible. And they were willing to die for this. So the Jewish people, the practices that they used, the theological motivation that they had, and the absolute attention to detail gives us a high degree of confidence in the biblical text. Let's think about internal evidence for the historicity of the Old Testament. This is where we compare the authors with each other. The Hebrew Bible was written over 1,000-year period. If you agree with Mosaic authorship, you know, as the first 5 books of the Bible teach, that you have Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, Numbers, Leviticus, they claim to have been written by Moses. And so, except for, well, yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself. So that goes back to 1400 BC. The latest book would be Chronicles or Malachi, which would be 400 BC. So this is a constellation of 39 books written over 1,000 years, way bigger span, way more authors than the New Testament. And these are different types of people. You know, some are governors, some are prophets, some are priests, some are shepherds, you know, kings. I mean, these are people that are way different from one another. And yet we discover that they link up with each other with an incredible coherence. To be able to be writing and adding to something from somebody who was writing 1,000 years ago is truly incredible. Think about it like this. If I was to pick out 10 people, the same ethnicity, the same education, the same political leanings, the same background, the same socioeconomic background, and I was to give you some kind of a discussion prompt, like capital punishment. What do you believe about the ethics of that? You would have more difference between those 10 people than you would in the 39 books of the Old Testament. So even people close in time and space and culture, you'd have more difference between them than you would over 1,000-year period of people of vastly different strata when it comes to, you know, society, culture, ethnicity, etc. Here are some of the things that were very unique to the Hebrew Scriptures. For one, a strict monotheism. G. Ernest Wright, in his book on this, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, he was a Harvard scholar, he points out that the concept of monotheism emerges seemingly out of nowhere in the Hebrew Scriptures. The surrounding worldviews and the kind of historical milieu in which the Hebrew Scriptures were born, they believed in polytheism, they believed in henotheism. As you move farther east, it was pantheism, but the belief in one singular, infinite, personal God seems to just come on the scene. And this is something we take for granted when we read our Bibles. And yet when you read the Hebrew Bible cover to cover, that's one thing that sticks out so clearly. Rejection of magic and the occult. G. Ernest Wright, big proponent of this as well. He claims there isn't a single magic incantation in the Hebrew Bible. This was in the ancient Near East where they had all sorts of magic incantations. You know, healing people, you would have to get out the fish guts and then you'd have to get the tea leaves and move it all together and then form a paste and put it on someone's eyes. The Old Testament, you don't see a single scripture about that. Nothing about it. Only strictly forbidding it. Completely different than the culture. The concept of objective morality or sin, very different from the other cultures where you did have a concept of moral taboo or wrongdoing, stuff like that. However, it was very capricious, where the gods would say one thing on one day and they'd say another thing on another day. The God of the Old Testament, very clear, right is right, wrong is wrong. The Old Testament believes in lex rex. This is Latin for the law. Lex is king, rex. The law is king. In the ancient Near East, they believed in not lex rex, but rex lex, that the king is law. If the king says something is law, it's law. Now, how does that fit into our Old Testament? I'll give you one example. 2 Samuel chapter 12, where Nathan comes through and he busts out David, King David, a military man, tough, a murderer, and he says, "You committed adultery, you committed murder, thou art the man." In the ancient Near East, what would the king have done? Oh, thanks for sharing. Anyone want to take his head off for me? That's just the way it was done back then. If you disagreed with the king, rex lex, the king is law. David, how does he respond? He repents before God that there's a law greater than the king, the law from Yahweh. And we see that it's replete throughout the Old Testament, where we see that, you know, the prophets are calling out the kings, and there's this idea that there's a law above the king. The sacrificial system is something that we see consistently throughout the Old Testament, even in, during the exile, constantly Daniel, think of Daniel praying backward toward Jerusalem. Something's wrong because the temple isn't there. Cross-referencing, think of Daniel chapter 9 where it says that he's reading the book of Jeremiah. And he's finding out that there's only 70 years until they get out of their captivity. You see Isaiah lining up with, I can't remember the other one, we're going to cover this next week, Isaiah and Micah. They have word for word matching with one another. The kings with Isaiah 39, they're constantly pointing the finger at each other and cross-referencing each other and agreeing with each other. Jerrinus Wright is famous for saying that the incredible thing about the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, is that it's not written in the genre of mythopoeic literature. You probably can figure out what that means. Myth, poetry. That in the ancient Near East, you came up with all these mythologies or poetries to describe your deities. And Jerrinus Wright says this is written as if it's in a different genre altogether. This isn't mythopoeic. This is considered history. I mean, even as you read through, where you read the prophets, and they're constantly referring back to what? The Exodus. Or they're referring back to creation. Or they're referring back to Abraham, as though these were real people. We also see incredible self-incrimination. For example, the book of Jonah. You read Jonah. And at the end of Jonah, what do you discover? That Jonah is such an incredible prophet? No, that he's a terrible prophet. He fights God tooth and nail. Even at the end, where at the end of the book of Jonah, God's like, you know, how you doing? He's just like, I just want to sit here and die. And many people say, well, Jonah must have written that. Why? Because, why would they say Jonah had written that? If he hadn't written it, it'd be totally self-incriminating. Why would you include this in your own scriptures? These are embarrassing details. This would be against what is called the JEDP theory, or the Wellhausen hypothesis. You're going to be reading Gleason Archer this week, where Archer, who was a world-class scholar, as I said before, I believe he, when he died, he knew 12 dead languages. The guy was just a freak. And he's got a thorough critique of the JEDP theory. In short, the JEDP theory says that there are four different sources. Yahwist, Eloist, Deuteronomistic, which is like the kingly source, or the law, and then the priestly source. And all four sources had different scriptures, and they all kind of mushed together, and then a final author-editor came through and compiled all the sources into one Hebrew Bible. So like, yeah, the book of Genesis, yeah, I know people claim it was written by Moses. Or Exodus, you know, in Exodus 24, it says that he put his writing in the book. Yeah, like Moses wrote the book. But now we know that there are actually four different sources, the J source, the E source, the D source, and the P source. And they all had their different conceptions of God, and they were all kind of mushed together. And a later redactor, author, editor, turned those into our Hebrew scriptures. One example, Genesis 1:1 to 2:3. What is the word used for God? In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. That's the E source. They call God Elohim, the Eloist source. When you get to Genesis 2:4, all the way to the end of the chapter, it doesn't use Elohim, it uses Yahweh. That's the J source, Yahwist, Jahwist, Yahweh. And so they say, see, they had two different creation stories. Genesis 1 is the Eloist source. Genesis 2 is the Yahwist source. And they have them side by side because they couldn't figure out which one they liked more. And so they kind of just smushed them together, author, editor. Now, if you haven't heard this theory before, hopefully I've at least made you afraid of it. So you'll do your reading this week and see what Archer has to say about this theory. I am very unpersuaded by it. And you'll have to decide for yourself this week. What do you think? All right, let's think about the external test. The external test for the Old Testament. Let's start, I'm going to try and do this chronologically here. Let's start with the Pentateuch. Penta meaning five books of the Bible. These are the first five books of the Bible. The JEDP theory would say that these sources were written sometime, well, different sources are dated at different places, like the J source is 650, and the E source is, you know, 500 BC. Whereas the Pentateuch itself claims to have been written after the Exodus. And yet, so that would be a thousand-year discrepancy there. All right, let's think about this. The Pentateuch, was it written by somebody in 500 BC? Huh, I wonder. Or was it written by Moses or somebody from the 15th century BC? Well, let's look at external tests. The Pentateuch uses a greater percentage of Egyptian words than elsewhere in the Old Testament. Whoa, that's interesting. Why would somebody in 500 BC be using Egyptian words when they're living in Israel? Unless the author was someone who lived in Egypt, was trained in the palaces of Egypt, was put in a basket and rescued by the queen or princess of Egypt, and was totally educated in all the ways of the Egyptians. Acts chapter 7, as Stephen says. The author of the Pentateuch says the Shechem is in Canaan. Genesis 33:18. You're like, you totally breeze right over that as a modern reader. If this was somebody writing this in 500 BC, when all the Israelites are in the land of Canaan, they're in Israel, and he has to say, oh yeah, Shechem is in Canaan. That'd be like me having to tell you, Columbus is in Ohio. You'd be like, of course. Unless the author is writing from Egypt or in the wilderness before they get to the land, and he's describing, when we get to Canaan, Shechem is in Canaan. It describes Egyptian weather. The author describes Egyptian weather. This is before Wikipedia, right? This is before you would know what kind of weather was happening in Egypt. Does this sound like it's someone writing from Israel, from Palestine, or somebody who grew up in Egypt? The author mentions Egyptian flora and fauna, the acacia trees, tahash skins, antelopes, rock badgers. These aren't germane to Israel. These are animals, offspring, and flora and fauna of Egypt. Moreover, the laws given for the Jewish people, many of these are given for people in the desert. So have you ever read through your Old Testament and just been like, what is the point of all these laws? And they're specifically for when you're in the desert walking around, this is what you do. Why would they include these laws in 500 BC when they're stable, they're inside their kingdom, or 650 or whatever? Why would you invent laws for a desert people when you're already living in your lush area in Israel? This is my favorite one here. Genesis 13:10. Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar. Now think about that for a second. The plain of the Jordan, if you're an author living in Israel, you would have no reason to describe what that area looked like. The author is comparing it to what? He's comparing it to a geographical place in Egypt. It's not that he's saying that the Jordan was familiar and the Egyptian part was unfamiliar, just the opposite. He's saying, you guys know what the land of Egypt and that land towards Zoar was? That's the part you're familiar with? Yeah, that's what the whole plain of the Jordan is like. So does that sound like a 6th century BC author living in Israel? Or does it sound like someone writing from outside of Israel? The term covenant, berith, was used in the 2nd millennium BC. And the type of covenant that was used in the Mosaic covenant was the particular style of covenants which were used between 1500 and 1000 BC. So the type of legal contract that is used in the book of Exodus and Deuteronomy was the same kind of contract that was set up during that time period. That doesn't fit with a 6th century BC author. The suzerainty treaty in Deuteronomy fits the pattern used in the 2nd millennium BC. A suzerain is somebody who is the king, and then a vassal is somebody who kind of works for the king. So there were many of these suzerainty treaties where the king would come in and give certain things to his vassals. Well, that type of treaty was used in the 2nd millennium. That's 2000 to 1000 BC. That would have been when Moses was around. Not used in the 1st millennium BC when the JDP theory says it supposedly was constructed. The Nuzi tablets. This is just awesome. Okay, digging in modern-day Iraq, which was ancient Nuzi, they discovered thousands of cuneiform tablets which date to 1500 BC. Before this, critics of the Bible said there's no way Moses could have written the Pentateuch. Why? because they didn't write back then. They didn't know how to write. They were illiterate. They just didn't have writing. Then we come across a cache of thousands of these tablets. And guess what they mention? Dating to 1500 BC. They mention things like how to sell your birthright vis-a-vis Esau and Jacob for a bowl of soup. Or surrogate wives, where Abraham is sitting there and saying, well, my wife Sarah, she's not going to be able to get pregnant. I'm going to go get a handmaiden, Hagar. That was a common practice at this time. Deathbed blessings. Think about when Isaac gives away his deathbed blessing to Jacob versus Esau. Or to flash forward to the end of Genesis, where Jacob gives away his deathbed blessings to his 12 sons. This kind of thing was normal at the time, and it fits in with the New Zedek era tablets. Then we have the Ebla tablets. These are 15,000 clay tablets in Syria, dating to 2300 BC. Now again, critics used to say he couldn't have written it. Why? Well, because they didn't write back then. This is 800 years before we would say that Moses wrote this. And where are they finding all of this writing? Right in the same area of Israel. Syria, Iraq, right there, staring at us. What about the Tower of Babel? Now, we don't have remains of a large ziggurat that has been found made out of a mortar and brick, or whatever they had was a bitumen and tar. We don't have that. Of course we wouldn't have that. This is ancient, ancient history. But we have found up to 30 different ziggurats, these big religious towers that go straight up into the sky in the Mesopotamian region, some of which date back to 4000 BC. This was something which was practiced back then, and it seems to be at least to fit with the thing that we see in Genesis 11. Abraham, for years it was thought that the city of Ur, where he came from, was fake, fanciful, until they discovered the city of Ur in southern Samaria, which was thought to be a very advanced, relatively advanced civilization around 2000 BC. And so this would have been really difficult for Abraham to pick up and leave a really advanced area like this. Abraham's name has been found as early as the 16th centuries BC. The Hittites, I love this one. For years they said, you know, we don't have any mention of the Hittites, and yet we have some 50 different references to the Hittites in the Old Testament. Who are these people? I mean, they're apparently big players in the Hebrew Bible, but who are they? Never mentioned anywhere else. And so critics just looked at the Bible with scorn, saying, oh, please, this is completely made up. Until Hugo Winkler discovered this in 1906, he discovered an entire Hittite library. They were such an advanced civilization, they had 10,000 clay tablets. So far from just being completely non-existent, in fact, the Hittites were a very advanced civilization. Sodom and Gomorrah. This was earlier thought to be Bab ed-Dara, the location. More recently, this is thought to be Tal el-Hammam, and here's why. For one, when you read through the account in Genesis, what you discover is Sodom was supposed to be a really good, materialistic, financially prosperous site. Remember in Ezekiel chapter 16, he says, what was your sin, Sodom? You didn't care about the poor, you were rich, you were into avarice and greed. And so one of the issues of Sodom was that they were, you know, really wealthy. And it makes sense. You know why? Three reasons. Location, location, location. Sodom was right there. It was an awesome trade route. And yet, in this area, between 1850 and 1500 BC, which is referred to as the Middle Bronze Age, this site was completely abandoned. So this would be prime real estate to have some kind of a business going, and it was abandoned for 3.5 centuries. On this particular site, Stephen Collins has shown that there is an ash layer in some areas about 1 meter deep. That's how thick it is. And they found pottery that dates to this time period, you know, 1800 BC, which would have been the time, roughly. And the pottery has been turned to glass. The sand has been turned to glass. Now, this is a very fertile region, this area. The investigators of this have said this looks like some kind of a flash event. I mean, to have sand turn to glass, you need heat somewhere around 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And this was some kind of a flash event that destroyed this whole area. What about Joseph? Well, was he Egyptian in origin? Was this just some kind of a 6th century BC Palestinian JEDP group coming up with this story? Not likely. Potiphar, remember Potiphar throws him into prison for trying to, or actually, for being suspected of messing around with his wife, or assaulting his wife, actually. Potiphar and Potipharah share variations of the same name. In Egyptian, it means he whom Ra, the sun god, has given. The names for these different officials have Egyptian names. Joseph, he says, the expression over the house, his title in Genesis 39, was an ancient Egyptian expression. It was not a Hebrew expression. The title he's given is Egyptian. Why would a 6th century BC author import an Egyptian title unless the author was Moses, who came from Egypt and would have known these titles? The word magician, mentioned in Genesis 41, that's Egyptian, not Hebrew. Joseph, I love this one, sold for 20 shekels, the price of a slave. You're like, okay, so what's the big deal? Well, James Hoffmeyer, one of my professors, world-renowned archaeologist and Old Testament scholar, he showed that between 2000 and 1500 BC, in that 500-year range, the rate for a male adult slave was 20 shekels. If you moved from 2500 to 2000, the price was 10 shekels. If you move from 1500 to 1000 BC, the price with inflation went up to 30 shekels. So the exact right price of a slave is used for Joseph at the exact right date in history. They got the inflation right. Joseph, in Genesis 50:22, he lives for 110 years. And Hoffmeyer has shown that in Egyptian culture at this time, for whatever reason, don't ask me why, they thought that to live for 110 years was the sign of an ideal life. It's kind of like when somebody says, you know, you get your 70 or whatever it is in the Old Testament. They got their ideal time. In Egypt, if you lived for 110 years, that was the ideal time. And that's precisely how long Joseph lived. Moses. Moses' name is Egyptian. It's the Egyptian word for child. So isn't that funny? Is it the princess or the Pharaoh's wife? I think it's the princess picks up Moses. She picks him up and she's like, Moisha. Child. Reminds me of the story where the girl's name was Famali. And my loved one said, so how'd you come up with that name? That's really pretty. And they said, well, we got her from the hospital and on the baby carriage it said Famali. F-E-M-A-L-E. Famali. Anyways, James Hoffmeyer says the words basket, bulrush, pitch, reed, river, river banks are all Egyptian cognates. All these words are borrowed from Egypt. What about the Exodus? This one I just learned this past year. This is what's called the Ippur Papyrus, or the Papyrus Leiden is the official name for it. This particular individual, Ippur, he was known as a wise sage in Egypt. And so he was kind of venerated as a wise person. And this papyrus was copied in 1300 BC. Now, I would argue that the Exodus happened in 1500 BC. Some people think it was 1300 BC. Okay, here's what it says. In 2:10, it says, the Nile River is blood. Men thirst after water. Fire has gone up on high. Remember in the Exodus account, it says that hail mixed with fire came down to destroy the land. Produce is destroyed. That comes right out of the 10 plagues. Cattle moan. Remember, the cattle are killed by the hail. Darkness is on the land. Was that the 9th plague, where darkness is at the very end? It says in 4:3, children of princes are dashed against the walls. The chosen children are laid out dead, which could line up with the firstborn are dead. In 3:2, it says slaves have gold around their necks. Remember when the Jews left in the Exodus, they pilfered all the money from the Egyptian people. Basically, they had been slaves for 400 years. And they're like, well, we're going to take our late paychecks, and took the gold with them. That could be reminiscent of this here. And then it says, poor slaves flee to the desert. Many people say, well, it's just not close enough. Or they say, well, the Nile River is blood. That could be metaphorical. Stuff like that. This seems like a dead ringer. There's a document from 1300 BC. It's referred to as the destruction of mankind. It's Egyptian in origin. And it uses the word Yahweh to describe God. This is the Egyptian version of Yahweh. Brad C. Sparks claims that there are dozens of Egyptian documents that have allusions to the Exodus. His work is forthcoming. We haven't seen it yet. It hasn't been published. So we can't put a lot of stock in that, but maybe we can wait to see what he comes up with. The Amarna letters. These are over 300 Akkadian cuneiform tablets. In letter 287, the prince of Jerusalem, so not a Jewish guy, but the guy who was the prince in Jerusalem at the time, wrote a letter back to Egypt. Are you with me? So he's not Jewish. He's there. This is dating to, I can't remember when, late, early, whatever you want to call it. He's writing back to Egypt, and he's talking about these people called the Hapiru, the Apiru, or the Habiru. You could pronounce it in three different ways. Habiru can either be translated Hebrew, Habiru, or this could be taken as a derogatory term for nomads and raiders. This could be where the term Hebrew came from, a derogatory term. These gypsies, you know, they come in, they raid your stuff, and then they leave. And he's writing back that these Habiru are coming in and attacking the city of Jerusalem, and that the lands of Egypt were lost to enemies. This could be a reference back to the Exodus event. Early evidence of Israel. For years they thought, well, Israel didn't really become a nation until maybe 700, because that's where archaeology just shoots through the roof, 800 BC. Yeah, it's probably 700 BC, definitely not as early as 1000, certainly not as early as, you know, 1400 or whatever, when Joshua comes in. Until they find the Merneptah Stela. This is a stela, basically a tall stone statue which records the conquests of the king. It's dated to 1200 BC, and it says, Israel is laid waste, and his seed is not. Now, if this was created in 1200 BC, and it's mentioning Israel as somewhat of a national power at the time, why would you put that on a stela if they weren't some kind of a national power? How much earlier did Israel exist before this stela was written? I mean, that's incredible to find that. David, Niels Peter Lemke, he's what's called a minimalist in archaeology. Minimalists give you the minimal amount of dating. So instead of saying we're going to go maximally back to 1500 BC, minimalists say, well, maybe it was 700 BC or 800 BC. So these guys are the big critics of the Bible, so to speak. Lemke says that King David is no more historical than King Arthur. He thought this was just wholesale fiction. Until 1994, they found the Tel Dan Stela, which says Jehoram, king of Israel, and this is all broken, and killed Ahaziah, son of, and then there's a break in the text. Then it states, I overthrew the house of David. This dates to 840 BC. David would have lived around 1000 BC. To add insult to injury, the Mesha Stela, which is also referred to as the Moabite stone, in line 31, it refers to the house of David. This also dates to 850 BC. Two independent sources referring to the house of David, and it's already been in existence for some time. Isaiah, this is one of my favorites. In the lists for the book of Isaiah, Isaiah mentions Sargon II, but in the lists from extra-biblical literature, you have lists of Assyrian kings. However, they skip over Sargon II. So every list we look at, there is no Sargon II, and yet Isaiah mentions him living at this time in the 8th century BC. So for years, they said, here's a clear example of the author making something up. Until Paul Emile Botta discovered his 10-ton, 15-foot sculpture. He also found a 25-acre palace devoted to none other than Sargon II. In one of the inscriptions, it reads, "I besieged and conquered Samaria. I led captive away 27,280 people." Not only was Sargon there, he also invaded Israel, and he also messed them up. Once you hit 853 BC, according to K.A. Kitchen, archaeology really vastly increases, because at this point, the Assyrians, who kept really good records, they also kept records of their enemies. And so the Assyrians will very frequently refer to Israel. So we're not even getting into the archaeology after that point, because if we were to do that, it would take 10 weeks. But what we have so far is good evidence that what we're dealing with here is historical. Now, by contrast to this, you might say, well, yeah, a lot of religions are that way. Not true. The Judeo-Christian religion is very unique in this regard. Let's think about Eastern religions, for example. If you study Eastern religions, one of the things you quickly discover is that they had little to no interest in history at all. You could have the teachings of Buddhism without Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. The teachings came from him, but Buddhists don't really care that he lived. I mean, they believe he lived. They believe that he gave them the teachings of Buddhism, the five pillars, or what is it, the fivefold path? Eightfold path, yeah. They believe that he gave them the eightfold path of Buddhism, but they don't have any kind of commitment that he was historically a person. You could have the teachings of Buddhism without Buddha. And so it is with Eastern religion. It's more about the teachings. It's more about the wisdom, not the historical peculiarity that these are actual historical events. Islam, if you've ever read the Quran, very clear anachronisms that jump out at you. In Surat is plural, 7, 12, 20, 26. It places the practice of crucifixion back in the time of ancient Egypt. Crucifixion didn't become an art and science of execution until the Assyrians in 500 BC. And then the Romans made it popular in 100 BC. But crucifixion just didn't exist at this time. And yet the Quran teaches that. The Quran in Surah 19 confuses Miriam, you know, Miriam, Moses' sister from 1450 BC. It confuses Miriam with Mary, Jesus' mother. A clear confusion. It confuses the Trinity. It refers to the Trinity as the Father, Son, and Holy Mary. This shows Muhammad's lack of understanding with Orthodox Christianity, that he thought that the God, the Son, had a goddess mother, and that the Father and the Mother produced a third God. It denies that Jesus died on the cross. Surah 4, Ayah 157. It says it appeared to them that he died. And so many Muslim imams today will say that, yes, Judas actually took his place and appeared like Jesus. Allah made it look like it was Jesus, but it wasn't really Jesus. Well, this is a fact of history that is called by Gerd Ludemann, the atheistic German skeptic. The crucifixion is indisputable historically. John Dominic Crossan, extreme critic of the New Testament, he says the crucifixion is, quote, as sure as anything historical can ever be. Bart Ehrman calls it one of the most certain facts of history. The crucifixion is bedrock history. The Quran teaches against it. Now, that's just what it gets wrong. Most of the Quran, if you've read it, doesn't really mention times, places, dates, stuff like that. A lot of it is just direct teaching from Allah. And so you read the teaching, but none of it's really grounded in history. It's not like there's a narrative, stuff like that. What about Mormonism? Mormonism places horses and elephants in America before colonization. Now, does that sound, just so you know, there were no horses and elephants in America before we brought them over. So, does that sound like someone who was getting direct revelation from God, who knew what was happening back there at that time? Or does that sound like someone who in 1830 was starting a religion and was looking around at the United States and said, yeah, there's probably horses and elephants back then. They're here now. It claims in Nephi chapter 2, the river Laman emptied into the Red Sea. There is no river Laman that empties into the Red Sea. There's no remains of a river that empty into the Red Sea. There is no river. It says the people were called Christians back in 73 BC, Alma 46. That's a century before Jesus died. And it's more than a century before the Christians were first called Christians at Antioch. According to Acts, is it chapter 11? Somewhere in there. It says the compasses existed 1,000 years before their invention. Now again, does that sound like someone who's getting divine revelation? Or does it sound like someone in the 19th century saying, I bet they had compasses back then? It says that the word Bible existed in the 6th century BC. The term Bible doesn't appear until 1500 AD. One of the worst parts against Mormonism. This is kind of wild to consider. The Mormon claim is that the angel Moroni buried these sacred plates in 400 AD in the Americas, and in them had all of these extra books to the Bible. So Mormons believe in the Bible, but they also believe in extra books, the Doctrines and Covenants, the Book of Mormon, and so forth. And those books were said to have been buried in gold plates. And then Joseph Smith found those and pulled them out and read them, had them translated. Read them, and then had them put into the Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon, Pearl of Great Price, Doctrines and Covenants, and the Bible. What's interesting is those three extra books that I named, quote, now think about this, quote from the King James Bible of 1611. So they were buried in 400 AD, uncovered by Joseph Smith, read aloud and written down, but quote the King James Bible some 6,000 times. So we would have to believe that this angel wrote down the King James Bible in Elizabethan English some 1,400 years before the translation, or 1,200 years before the translation ever existed. A Mormon scholar, Simon Sutherland, in his book Losing a Tribe, he was trying to seek out to prove that there was a lost tribe of Israel that made it over to the Americas. And as they made it over here, that's the story of much of the narratives of Mormon theology, that they were here over in America, and then Jesus came to visit them, etc., etc. So have any of you gotten the DNA swab? They swab your mouth, and they say, my dad just got it done, 62% Irish. It's pretty freaking good, man, just to think. If you marry one time with someone who's not a pure-blooded Irish superior person like myself, then your genes become 50% right at that point. Anyways, that's a side note, and pretty racist to say as well. Since that time, they've been doing DNA testing to see where your ethnicity comes from, right? Many of you have probably gotten that done. Well, he went and studied all these Native Americans and studied modern-day Jews. There is no similarity whatsoever. Where was that book published? Salt Lake City. We can't find it. One of my favorite things to do in discussing these kind of things with Mormons is to say, hey, Book of Mormon, hey, where's all the maps? They're like, excuse me? The maps. Like in my Bible, there's like a bunch of maps, like, you know, Judah, Samaria, Antioch, Rome. There's maps because, you know, there's all these historical things that are mentioned, and then your study Bible will say, oh, it's here, it's there. Where's your guys' maps in the Book of Mormon? Doctrine and Covenants, where's the maps? Pearl of Great Price, where's the maps? Like, where did this stuff supposedly happen? They don't have any maps, because none of this stuff has been found. Well, so we are sitting on gold when it comes to the Bible, an incredibly invested book of history. So let me pause there for any questions one might have. No, I think it's a piece of the puzzle, because if the Bible is claiming that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, the Torah, the first five books, if it's making that claim, then we should expect to be able to back up the authorship of the author of the Pentateuch. Now, what you're going to read this week is the JEDP theory, which is going to say, no, 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 this was all written 700 BC, 600 BC, maybe pre-exilic, post-exilic, somewhere in there. And so I think we can show that there's markers all throughout the text with throwaway comments that this was written by someone with an Egyptian origin from that time, even. Yeah. Good question. So in Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, it uses Elohim, and then in Genesis 2:4 and following, it goes back to Yahweh. And then throughout the book of Genesis, it's Elohim, it's Yahweh, it's Yahweh, it's Elohim. I believe that it's stylized by the author, that Elohim is the word that you would use for God as the creator. And Yahweh is the word you would use for God as the covenant maker. So Genesis 1, he creates everything and he creates humans. But in Genesis 2, he makes a covenant with them. And throughout the rest of the Old Testament, when God makes a covenant, he shows up as YHWH, Yahweh. So that's how I would explain it. To say that there's two different names for God in the Old Testament and then to say, well, those must be two different authors, please. Even in Genesis 2, it says the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, did such and such. The way I describe it one person calls Indiana Jones Dr. Jones in class, and then somebody else calls him Indy, and somebody else calls him, you know, I don't know, Harrison Ford, whatever. The whole point is you can relate to people in different ways, and I think it shows the versatility of how God wants to reveal himself to us.